everyone, and welcome to Rewatchable, episode number 130. Today we'll be discussing The Legend of Korra, book 3, episode 12, Enter the Void, and 13, Venom of the Red Lotus. These are seriously intense episodes. If you would like to contact us to talk about these seriously intense episodes, you can email us at rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com. You can reach us on Twitter at re_watchable. You can comment on this post on hypeable.com, and you can come hang out on Tumblr at rewatchablepodcast.tumblr.com. My name is Michal. I am your host for today. I am a super fan. I am tired, and I am joined by Mitchell, fellow superfan, and newbies Karen and Brittany. How's it going, guys?
Hey. Good.
Howdy ho.
Cool. So, fun facts. Oh yeah, it's cold, and I'm pissed off at that. There's your fun fact. I am not pleased. We've been having an Indian summer, and I just kind of pretended that it was going to continue for a long time, and now it's cold, and yeah.
Yeah, Karen just showed us a picture of snow in New York, and I was like, wow, it's kind of early.
Ugh. Yeah, no, I'm not a fan. Karen, what's your fun fact?
I am now the proud owner of a Keurig machine, and I don't know how I ever lived without one.
Oh my gosh, yes. Those are essential for life.
Yes.
How about like that apple cider one? That one is just heaven.
Yeah, you can make more than just coffee.
Yeah, I make a lot of tea.
Oh, they're so... I love a Keurig. You're making me jealous.
Now you can make Campbell's soup in it, though, and that seems just like science has gone too far.
Huh.
Yeah,
that's like against the laws of feminism or physics.
Sure, yeah, of course. Only women can make soup, guys. The Keurig is taking over our jobs. Brittany, what's your fun fact?
It's really cold and I love it. I love the cold. I would live in a cold place all year round if I could. So yes. I'm very excited that it's cold and there was frost on my car this morning.
New fun fact, Brittany's a terrible person. Mitchell, what's your fun fact?
You live my fun fact place, is, right? Michal, you're going to love this one. I watched Crimson Peak last night, essentially blind. So the part in your review that you wrote, I just heard the title so far, A Pretty Face and an Ugly Heart. See, I couldn't tell it had a pretty face. I mean, I really, like, it was almost like watching a YouTube video on 240p. And I was like,
physically blind?
I'm not physically blind. I'm just like, I'm 240p in real life. And I lost my glasses, so I'm walking around the world not seeing things.
No, I knew blind, so I was wondering why. Oh, because you lost your glasses. Okay, that's the part.
Yes, yeah, okay. I guess I should have explained that. So so that's fun. I can't drive anywhere right now. That's kind of a fun fact.
Just missed the only point of seeing Crimson Peak, which is
to look at Tom Hiddleston.
Yeah, to look at Tom Hiddleston. Yes. and the costumes, basically.
I mean, you see his butt. And I guess that's a big deal, because I don't think that's happened before, no?
I don't know. I actually, for as big of a Tom Hiddleston fan as I am, have not seen a lot of his other movies.
Seen a lot of GIFs of him fairly nude, so...
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm sure. Weird, because, like, it's sad, because the only press about this movie right now is, like, Tom Hiddleston's nude scene. I'm like, do we have nothing else to talk about Hollywood?
Well, it's not a great movie, so it's a better movie.
See, I wouldn't know, though. I mean, it just felt like a really long, drawn-out pixel fest. That's all I felt. I guess that was my own fault for seeing a movie blind-ish.
Yeah, definitely get your glasses back, because otherwise, life sucks without glasses. Cool. All right, so we will get started with Chapter 12, Enter the Void. In this episode, Korra decides to trade herself over to the Red Lotus in order to save the captured airbenders. However, the Red Lotus double-cross Korra and hold on to their one anti-card. Bolin discovers his ability to lava bend while Kai rescues Korra's friends from a collapsing northern air temple. Furious being tricked, Korra instigates a fight between both sides. Well, to be fair, she's trying to escape. Sue manages to bring Plea down, which subsequently releases Zaheer of his only earthly tether. With the ability to freeform fly, Zaheer captures Korra, chains her up Vitruvian Man style, and orders the administration of a poison into the hapless Avatar. It is pretty intense. So Karen and Brittany, I just wanted to get your initial thoughts on this episode. I'm going to do this with the second one too. How did you feel?
I really liked it. I really liked both of them. Definitely intense. Definitely wasn't entirely sure how far they were going to go with some of the plot points and, you know, characters and whether they would survive or not. So, yeah, they were really good finale episodes.
Yeah, I agree. I loved all the action and the animation, especially. I'm a huge fan of bending, as you know. So I was pumped to have like almost 50 straight minutes of so much bending. And Bolin was fantastic. And I like that we don't know where season four is heading. Like this is the first finale, I think, out of both Avatar and this show, where it doesn't feel wrapped up, which I like. I like that we are going like into season four, not like, you know, it's not going to start fresh. There's like still kind of a threat hanging there and I don't know what's going to happen. And I love that. So I really liked both of the episodes. I know you asked about the one in particular, but I watched them back to back, so I can't really separate them.
Yeah, no, it's hard to separate these two. They definitely, I mean, like most of the Avatar finale, they kind of blend together.
Yeah.
But I guess starting from the beginning, how did you guys feel about Mitch? How did you feel about the deal the sort of the plan that the team comes up with, that Korra will sort of attempt to sacrifice herself for the Airbenders, but hopefully not have to? And then ultimately, yeah, that does not exactly work out.
Well, it feels so adult in a way that the adults are the ones making the plan this time, not, you know, the teens. And that's a big deal that, you know, we have like Sue and Lin involved and Tenzin and whatnot. And everyone just seems like in such a high peril to the point where it's like, okay, everything before this was just kids play. Like Korra could deal with that. But now she needs help. Like if she doesn't have us plan with her, if we don't figure this out with like our super awesome, not White Lotus team, but even better, like they need a name. I don't know. Is this the crew still? Are we too big for the crew?
I guess we're like Team Korra or Team Avatar.
Yeah. Team Avatar is just, this is what Atla needed, because those children running around, like the White Lotus came to save them in the end of the day ish. But it was basically just like these kids going around and like having Agni Kais and forming giant spirit monsters out of their bodies. It was just, I'm appreciating the realism of Korra to say like, okay, you know, we're going to sit down and not let these 12-year-olds run the show. Well, you know, in this case, 16-year-olds or whatever, but it's so like intriguing too, because the plans are trying to come up with, like, I'm glad they're showing us that part. It's important, because I feel if we didn't see that, these episodes wouldn't feel at such a high stake, because we wouldn't know who else is involved as much. So this scene really does a good job for me to like get me into it.
Yeah, and it's interesting too, because Korra, you know, I mean, Korra has to be involved here. She is the reason why this is all happening, really, because of the Red Lotus's interest in her. And I mean, I think I find it very mature how seriously she takes that. You know, she doesn't like say it's unfair. She doesn't like whine about it. She's just like, no, this is, I mean, she maybe takes it too personally, but she, you know, feels horribly guilty that this is happening because of her and is determined to fix it. So moving on, I mean, Brittany, did you think that there was anything, did you think that the plan was going to go well? Was it like doomed from the start, or did you think maybe they had a chance that this like double cross that they were trying to pull off?
I was really hopeful that Bumi and Kaya were not captured. If you listened to last week, I was so dead set that they were not captured. And so I was just waiting for them to show up and save the day the whole time. So I'm like, oh, they can totally pull this off. So I always had that in the back of my mind. So I guess I was very hopeful that it was going to end well, but I'm kind of glad that it didn't. Like, there was so many complications, because the villains in this right now, like the Red Lotus, the four, they're so good, and there are only four of them, so it's like that that having them split up and like having different elements attacking them, like you have like air and then you have like fire versus water and stuff like that. It was just like the threat was always so high that towards like the end of this episode in particular, I was like, oh crap, like things are not going to work out. And I like that. Like, I like that there wasn't this like, you know, moment in the end where it's like, okay, everything's solved. Like it was like the threat felt so real. So I got a little discouraged when I realized that Kaya and Bumi were not going to come and save the day. And I liked that. I like being kept on the edge of my seat.
Yeah, there definitely is no saving the day, I think, in these two episodes. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, obviously everybody gets out of it, but there's it's definitely a Pyrrhic victory for sure. I just want to touch on for 1 second. Karen, what did you think of the scene between oh my gosh, Zaheer and tall lady, what's her name? Plea. where, you know, we kind of, not that we didn't know, I guess, but they, the showrunners definitely reaffirm for us that they are in love and genuinely in love and that they are true idealists in this.
This is actually my favorite scene because I really liked their relationship a lot, like a lot more than I thought I would. And it just, even though they're obviously the bad guys, I feel like they clearly think that they're doing the right thing. They're not just crazy. They don't want to just, you know, watch the world burn. Like they really believe in what they're doing. And the fact that they're still like human, they can still fall in love and feel very genuine toward each other was really important to me in terms of painting them as kind of my ideal villain, because sometimes you really want to like the bad guy. Sometimes you really want to feel like that torn between, okay, who do I really side with here? And even though clearly I do side with Korra because I don't believe that what they're doing is a good thing, I can really understand where they're coming from. And I guess just the fact that they were in love with each other meant a lot to me. And I just thought it was a really beautiful kind of relationship despite what they were doing to Korra and the world.
Yeah, I agree. It's a very, it's a great scene in that way. And I love that Lee is like 6 feet taller than Zaheer.
Me too. I was like, man, thank you for representing the tall girls in the world.
Yeah, I'm the Zaheer in this relationship. I'm an evil mastermind airbender, sorry. So this all kind of comes to a confrontation. It turns out that the airbenders are not in the Northern Air Northern Air Temple. I'm sorry. They're not in the Northern Air Temple, and a really creepy scene. Mitch, do you remember if you saw that coming when
I did not. Like both times, I mean, I knew it was going to happen, but I still found her waterbending puppets believable. They look real. And I think about it now, and I think about these things sometimes in shows, like, how did they come up with that many? Like, who's the seamstress here? Seamster? Who's the one that's sewing together all these airbender costumes or whatnot? It just seems like really convenient. Maybe they planned ahead for this, you know? Maybe
had them because it was the Northern Air Temple. I mean, they probably just took a bunch of the extra
units. Oh, okay. That's a good point. Because I always found that part a little bit unrealistic until you mentioned that. And then I realized, yeah, of course, they're right there where you would have found the costumes anyways, or not costumes, just outfits. But yeah, no, I fall for it. And the reason I fall for it is because I'm like, okay, well, they always complain about having to draw Bolin and Mako's big family. And I'm sure they really don't want to have to draw all these airbenders. This is probably a really expensive episode to write and draw and whatnot. So they probably just wanted to, like, you know, slack a little. And I give them that. And then it's like, oh, wait, no, it's really just a trick. And it's very convincing to me.
Yeah. Karen and Brittany, did you see this coming at all?
I had a feeling that it wasn't going to be that easy, because I don't think that they would put all of the airbenders under, like, you know, in one kind of like place, that it would be that easy for half of Team Avatar to just fight and then kind of like align with the airbenders that quickly. So I was I thought it was cool the way that they like tricked. I thought that they were there for a little bit, and then as soon as they went away, I was like, oh good, this is awesome. I love these two episodes because I'm caught off guard so much, you know.
Yeah, but I agree. I definitely thought they were there to begin with, and then as soon as like we couldn't see their faces for the longest time, and I was like, uh-oh, something else is going on. But I definitely thought the trade was going to happen, because I was like, I don't know, these guys, yeah, they're the bad guys, but they kind of have their own principles, and really, they just want Korra. So I figured, you know, they'd just let the airbenders go, and everything would be fine. They'd get Korra and blah, 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 and I thought maybe they'd have to fight them, and Korra would have to fight them and once again lose, because they are incredible benders, and the fact that they tricked him like that was, yeah, really surprising.
Yep, yeah, definitely. Yeah, what I love about these episodes is there's so much going on, but none of it seems like extraneous. Like, I think, you know, the finale of two weeks ago, the season two, there's a lot going on, but some of it feels like placeholding, and this definitely feels like everything is necessary. Like, for example, you know, when Bolin and everybody are escaping from the air temple, Bolin discovers that he can lava bend, because yay, that's awesome. Bolin. I mean, I kind of called that. I think a lot of people probably called that, but it was still like a great scene.
Yeah. I didn't. Again, it was another thing where I was like, oh my god, that's so cool. Like, that I'm glad that he, like, I know he can't metal bend, which was fine. I was actually, like, really okay with him not being able to metal bend, but when he could lava bend, I was like, yeah, that's what I want.
Yeah,
I didn't know I wanted it, but I wanted it.
Well, yeah, I mean, and it makes sense with his personality. I mean, I think people have tried to do the whole, like, well, his mother was a firebender, so maybe that's why, and I don't know if that is a thing. Just because, like, the genetics of bending seem like a really dangerous way, you know, path to go down for me. But I think that it makes sense for Bolin. And I love, I'll talk about this later, but I love the scene where he just, like, goes in and discovers he's a lava bender while attempting to sacrifice himself. Well, there's a lot of attempting to sacrifice yourself in these two episodes, which is really kind of incredible. So, you know, these guys are kind of, they don't really have anywhere to go, because they kind of come to the end of the Northern Air Temple secret passage network, and there's a mountain. But luckily Kai is actually fine, as we learned last episode. And, they all bundle onto this tiny little sky bison who has had better days, and flee. So that's cool. Any last thoughts on the Northern Air Temple plot before we move on to the, I guess, the major fight scene?
No, I don't think so. I'm trying to remember what else happened while they were there. What I want to talk about takes place later, so we're fine.
Well, Tenzin wasn't dead. I guess that's important.
Right, Tenzin was not dead.
Tenzin was not dead, but he's very banged up. Like, this is what I want to talk about, but you don't really see Kaya and Bumi until we leave the Northern Air Temple, but they, Aang's kids are really banged up, and I didn't like that. I was so upset about that.
I was really worried about Tenzin, and I texted Natalie and was like, oh my god, I don't know if he's going to survive this. And she was like, I'm not telling you. And I was like, yeah, you're mean, whatever. And then I was like, then I texted her after, and I was like, he's still alive. She's like, they wouldn't kill Tenzin. I was like, you know what? Honestly, I don't know, because this season has been killing so everyone. Violent. I know. And I was like, if they really wanted to crush our hearts, they would do it. And I was really worried about him.
This sounds really, like, horrible. I wish they killed Tenzin, from the fact that they convinced me that they killed Tenzin, and I wanted them to go there, because this season quite nearly goes there. It is so close, especially with the violence in this episode, to going just way above Y7, because it does not feel Y7. And if they killed Tenzin after they had, so, you know, kind of shown him being brutally beat, that would have really... I mean, I don't know that I would have ever recovered in a good way. Like, that would have really stuck with me. Like, it's almost, you know, like, kind of Dumbledore dying before the Harry Potter series was over. spoiler alert, I guess. It's you know, Korra's mentor dying before she's able to, you know, utilize all that she can out of him. And I think that that would have really affected the story in a good way, to say like, okay, now Korra has to go on a journey of like maybe finding a new master, or even just trying to like deal with the guilt that she was the one that got Tenzin killed, if she wanted to, I guess, or just something like that. I think I really would have appreciated. But yeah, I love Tenzin, and I really do. I don't want him to die, but it's just plot wise, I do.
Yeah, I think if they, the problem that I would have had with them killing off Tenzin, besides, you know, it being very cruel, would be that there are no other masters of airbending. So, like, I guess, well, this happens next episode, but, like, you know, like, who's going to, like, you know, I mean, Jinora's as close as we got, but you need someone to, like, you know, make you a master. So that I think it would have left a lot of plot holes
for them to try and fill in. We have a lot of those Air Acolyte fangirls that could probably do something.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, I actually had the same thought, because I also wish that they had killed off Tenzin in a sad kind of way. Actually, I remember when I watched this episode for the first time, I like it aired in the summer, and I had like been teaching that morning, and I wrote the like, oh, Korra airs tonight thing, and stupidly like stealthily checked it on my phone to see if there were any comments while I was teaching, and saw somebody go like, oh my god, Tenzin, and I was like, oh my god, what happened? Oh no, this was the episode before this, right? No, still, but still, I was like in a panic and like all the way home and had no idea what was going on.
Like rushing home, like, is Tenzin okay? Is Tenzin okay?
Yeah, really, I was very distraught, and I think, I don't know. I mean, I think it's torn, but it also occurred to me that there is a you know, there's the practicality of, you know, really not. I mean, I think you could have had also, you know, a beautiful scene of like them kind of trying to be like, we have to make our own way as airbenders now and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, understandably that would have been like dark as F, you know, in addition to Korra's injuries, like that would have been kind of insane. Anyway, yeah, so we have this massive fight scene on the top of the mountain. A million things happen. The, you know, Team Korra is actually kind of outmatched, because it's basically just Gazan Gazan and Mingwa are piloting the thingy. It's, you know, Zaheer and Pali, and they are badasses. And, yeah, Pali dies, which I also saw coming because of that beautiful scene. And I was like, oh, they're just telling us this so that we have background. And then she dies, yeah.
Yeah. Are you a fan of that trope, I suppose, McCall? Or do you find it exhausting that you can call a character's death and the fact that they've had more focus in an episode?
I mean, I'm not a fan of it. I don't know if there's any way around it other than, like, better writing. But I think the writing for this season is very solid. I just think that there are a few times where, you know, I don't know why we couldn't have known this earlier. You know, I don't know exactly why they fit that in here.
Especially, I mean, I would have been happy if it was just like a look, like if they didn't have to have this full conversation in this episode, but they did it like three episodes ago to allow us. I mean, because they've had so much in between Red Lotus stuff. And like, you know, there was a whole siege where they took over a car trying to get into Republic City. Like that could have, I think, easily been replaced by like this, or supplemented by this scene, so that we wouldn't have seen it coming as easily. Because I mean, a look can still give it away, but it's not as in your face as like, I love you forever, I always waited for you, and you know, you're like, okay, bye. So one of you's gonna die.
I kind of thought, I mean, maybe I just misread the reunion scene wrong, but I kind of thought that they like were all paired off like when they first reunited. So it wasn't like as out of left field or in my face as like, I guess it was just like the first in my head, I was like, oh, this is the first time they're able to talk to each other. Like, you know, cause they've been like fighting ever since they left the truck behind, you know, and they weren't as in your face at the, in the beginning as the other guys. So, yeah, I kind of just assumed that they were a thing.
Well,
yeah. Well, they.
Well, Pali and Zaheer, don't they just suck face as soon as they see each other?
Yeah. So I was like, I guess it makes sense, but they we're kind of sensing, like, you know, okay, we're going to die because there's like 100 people coming after us, as opposed to like, you know, just Korra.
Yeah. And I don't know, whatever. I
like that Minghua seems to have absolutely no time for Kazan. Cause he's like, I feel like he's so much more into it than she is. She's just like, dude, I'm not, I got to fight people. Like, I don't have time for your romance crap.
Well, Minghua always, I think she's always got something going on. I think even in that, you know, I feel like she probably wasn't even too annoyed about going back to prison because she just would have gotten to torment the guards for, you know, ages. She's like, I don't think she's a pleasant person to be around.
No.
So, in addition on this, in this fight, so I actually want to ask you guys, Cannon and Brittany, how did you feel about Pali's death? Because the first, I think, two or three times, and I watched it very carefully again this time, and I still kind of miss that it happens. You know, there's like a few frames missing almost where like her head gets blown off. And I mean, I guess understandably so, but like you barely even hear a boom. So how did you feel about that? Were you like, oh my God, with, you know, the armor around her head, or were you just like confused and like what happened?
I honestly thought that they just captured her. I didn't think that she died until, you know, he was able to, like, you know, let go of all his earthly whatever. That's when it hit me. I was like, oh, she died. Like, I didn't think that, I really didn't catch that she was, like, they blew her up or whatever. I saw, like, the metal go on her head, and then there was so many explosions going on in this scene and then cutting back to the other scene that I kind of just didn't process that she died.
Yeah, agreed.
I knew she had died, and it was really violent. Like, I actually felt kind of sad, and I felt bad for her because what a way to go. I mean, she, like we've been saying, I mean, she's a bad guy. I guess she deserved it, but it was shocking, and I actually felt really bad for Zaheer. Like I said, I really liked their relationship and this sort of like easy camaraderie that they had, that it was so simple. It seemed like they didn't have any drama or anything like that. It was just like complete and utter trust in each other. And after all of the back and forth we've had with Korra and that kind of thing, it was just kind of a nice relationship to attach myself to. And then her head blew up. So that was unfortunate. But yeah, it was pretty shocking.
I mean, essentially, that's the equivalent of having your head microwaved, but very quickly. That just, that can't be pleasant.
Yeah.
So but I agree with you, Michal, because every time I watch this, I do feel like I feel like they're not even just frames missing, but they're like maybe a full, you know, 1 second's worth of footage that they had to cut because Nickelodeon was like, you can't show even like a shaking of the earth as this happened or some auxiliary explosion, because you literally hear clang and then it's just smolder. You don't hear boom. It's totally missing the explosion. And I think that's purposeful censorship on Nickelodeon's part. It has to be, because this is such a violent end to anyone's life, regardless of they're good or bad.
Yeah, I mean, I've spoken to friends about this, but I mean, and some of them were actually more okay with the way this happened than I was. I don't know. I feel like it was, I don't know. Yeah, I'm not one to like cry censorship or conspiracy theories usually, but I think, I don't know. I feel like there might have been some seconds cut there. Yeah, I agree. But anyway, what also happens is that Zaheer tosses Korra's dad off the mountain. She understandably freaks out. Turns out he's fine. Were you guys like concerned about that? I was kind of like, yes, good.
Like, kill someone, right?
Yeah, kill someone, and like, if you want to kill Tonarek, that's great. I have no use for this guy whatsoever.
don't ship him with anything.
I'm sorry. I don't. And he's a reminder of season two, and I didn't really like him in season two. So
I hated season two. I'm starting to like, the further we get removed from it, and we get episodes like this, I'm like, wow, Season yeah. two. Can't believe and I made it through.
That's good. Season three is so good that yeah. it's like, you know, that was a real scary moment there, like after season one was so great and season two was so disappointing, and then it was like, what is season three gonna be? Oh, it's gonna be amazing. Oh, fantastic. Right. Yeah. That's wonderful.
Now I'm nervous about season four. We'll talk about this at the end of the episode, but I'm yeah. a little nervous for season four.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's an interesting season. Cora kicks ass though, because she is kind of tied up and really is amazing. Yeah, shout out to Tonrak's ice punch, because that was super cool.
Yeah, his fighting is always impressive. Like, I always kind of, there are certain people, like when they show up, you're like, oh, it's that guy again, because you don't really like the character, but then they start fighting and you're like, right, you're actually kind of cool. I forgot.
Yeah. No, that's exactly how I feel about Tonrak, and that's why I'm still okay that he's alive. Because I'm like, okay, like it's cool if he wants to fight some more. Like he did pretty good job in this fight in not only cutting off the you know airship, but also distracting Zaheer for quite a while. And I think that is something to be said, because I don't know that there's not anything you can really do against. This criminal mastermind, but Tonrak certainly tries. I just want to know, maybe he trained under like Master Paku Jr. or something, because he's so good. And I wonder if he had a connection with Katara enough that he would have learned from her. But it's almost like a point that him and his brother are meant to be, his now dead brother, are meant to be like, you know, super waterbenders. But I'm like, I wish we had maybe, you know, a bit of their training or backstory, or just something. Maybe it'll come in comics or whatnot. But I would love to know, I think, just a little bit more about the brothers.
No, I could never see Unalaq again. I'm so happy.
You're like, Unalaq's dead, Tonrak's dead. Good. Check, check.
Moving on. But yeah, so Zaheer figures out how to fly. Because he let go his earthly tether.
Which is so cool. I've been wanting people to fly for so long. It's happening.
Yeah, it is kind of ironic that the first person we see fly sort of in Avatar is Azula, actually, even though she's not let go of any kind of earthly tether whatsoever. And I always kind of thought that was maybe a little bit overpowered, but, we kind of, things kind of move on from there. Cora gets taken to a secret underground Red Lotus highway complete with Logo, and they have strung her up in a very scary way with platinum chains, and Zaheer has gone like full on, I'm thinking of like the bad word for idealist. But whatever. Fanatic. He's totally gone at this point. There's no like funny remarks or whatever. This is just scary idealist. And they're bringing out poison. So dun dun dun. Karen, how did you feel about all this?
I actually liked Zaheer a lot less once he lost his earthly tether, because he moved from that kind of bad guy who has his reason for doing this to sort of just being a crazy person with no earthly tether. I mean, that's kind of the point, but I thought he lost a lot of what made him interesting to begin with and a lot of his humanity.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's intentional, because it's definitely, you know, it's what we're supposed to kind of, I think he has been so well crafted as a villain that that he kind of does need to go down the, and I guess given his most humanizing moment a couple minutes ago, so he does kind of need to go down the like, okay, now we actually really need to defeat this guy at this point.
I liked him a lot more. Because I liked that they had like weaved this, that like kind of like, I don't know what it's called, I guess like that talisman type thing with all the meditation and stuff. Like they weaved that in throughout the story, and you're kind of like waiting and waiting and waiting for it to be useful. And then it finally happens. And I thought that was just a really interesting layer that they like brought up in this episode. So I actually like thought that it was kind of cool. Like there's always this like greater thing that he's working toward, and his plan unfolded like so slowly, and I appreciated that like story element to it. So not that I like liked him as a character more. I thought he became more villainous, and like it's one of those people who I enjoy hating more because he's so calm. Like I like calm villains because I can get like I'm getting so worked up and they're not doing anything to like, you know, blow up and make me like, you know, freak out. So I liked his character a lot.
So here's a question. Do you think if Pulley hadn't died, Zaheer would have killed her in order to enact the whole letting go of his earthly tether?
No, I don't think so. I think she had to die because it was I think that would have locked up something in him. If he had to sacrifice her, it wouldn't have been as like, you know, I don't want to say spiritual because that's not the right word that I'm trying to go for, but it like I don't think it would have had the same effect.
I think it would have had a stronger effect because he would have had to have made that choice.
Well, I feel that that's the difference between either becoming a monster or becoming numb. I think his earthly tether was the fact that he loved her, of course. But then when she died for his cause, I think he just allowed himself to just understand that that was for his cause, period. And he didn't want to think about how he missed her or anything. He just like gone, done. And I think that if he was to sacrifice her, he would have assumedly a lot of guilt. And if he didn't, then he would become a monster. And I don't think that guilt would have allowed him to, you know, quote, release his earthly tether. I think that he still would have been attached to her spirit, her being enough to say, like, I can't fly yet. Like, this isn't happening. I did this. So that's why I think it wasn't even, like, an idea that crossed his mind.
Yeah, I don't think he realized that that was his earthly tether. I think he, because I think he would have realized in that scene, you know, we saw such a connection between them, and he's like, gee, what's my earthly tether? How do I let go of my earthly tether? And like his earthly tether comes in and he doesn't get it. And I think once she died so unexpectedly, it was like that moment of release for him, and he was just able to completely disconnect.
Karen, it's like when they cut Hercules's last string, they're trying to. It's like bang, you're done.
I still I don't know. I think it would have been more poignant if he had been the one to kill her and let that go. I mean, because sacrifices, they've been sacrificing, people have been sacrificing themselves throughout this entire episode. And I feel like if he had just been like, okay, this is the last thing, this is clearly not something I want to do, but I know in order to move on to the next step, this is the thing that I need to do in order to do that. It would have been, I guess, stronger for me if he had done it willingly rather than it sort of just happening.
I don't know. I honestly don't see that in his at being in his character. And I also don't think Plea would have been okay with that.
Cool with it, yeah.
I don't think she could have, like, yeah.
There's one note too. While we're still on the last bit of like what's going on with Pulley, she mentions that she was going to be the killing machine of a warlord, and that seems like a sentence that's just ripe with backstory that we're bound to hear about somewhere. Like I feel like that's going to come up somewhere again in the future of the series as it lives on, and especially in this comics.
Yeah, I don't know. It's Yeah, that line, I love that line, because that's just such an F you from the writers. To be like, wow, this really interesting thing happened when they were children, and then like, nope, you don't get to find out about it. I don't honestly see that ever being fleshed out anymore.
Oh, that would, okay, those would be cool comics, seeing the Red Lotus come together.
It would be cool comics, but I don't think, I mean, I think that is left to fans, you know, to work that out.
Yeah.
But there's a lot there, certainly. So I guess if we have no more thoughts on this episode, let's move on to favorite scenes and favorite lines. Karen, what was your favorite scene?
Just Zaheer and Plea's relationship in general.
Yeah, that was great. And you're the one who wanted to kill her? What the
heck? Well, I mean, I just think it would have made a bolder statement, but not that I really wanted him to do it.
It's like how I wanted Tenzin to die, yeah.
Kill your darlings, right?
Oh, man. Brittany, how about you?
Mine also involved Zaheer, and it was like what I was just talking about before, how the like whole meditation thing with that like little talisman thing came together into the actual plot. I thought that was a rewarding thing as a fan of the show to like see something be built into the series and you're not really quite sure what it is. And then to finally watch it all unfold. I really like that. And also I forgot, cause I just saw this in the show notes cause I added it in at the last minute. We didn't talk about the fact that they're in Zutara's true love cave. So
are they?
I mean, it might not be the same cave, but I looked up images and it looks very similar. With the little glowing, like the green glowing thing, right? Where Katara is like gonna heal Zuko's face with her healing thing.
Oh yes, yeah, those.
Don't remind me. Yeah. I can't. She should have done that as opposed to saving Aang.
And then really. I watched the clip of it on YouTube this morning when I was like, you know, going back and forth trying to like compare like what I was watching in Korra and images, and then I was like, I could just watch this scene again, you know, no big deal.
It's a great scene.
That's so a spiral. Good. Then you're going to decide that you want to just watch all of the show again, and then you'll be out.
That's good.
Mitchell, what was your favorite scene?
Mine's the beautiful animation from Tanrak's slow-mo ice punch, because I swear that they raised like the frames per second times 50 for the span of 2 seconds, and it just looks so detailed. It is so cool. So cool. But I'm honestly kind of pissed off that Tanrak always seems to go for like the one big final punch, and then he's like, oh, how did I get caught? I'm like, because you're going for the kill. Like, you should go to, like, you know, disable first. It's not the best way to fight Tanrak. It gets me upset because I want him to win there. I do want him to just kind of like maybe pierce through Zaheer's head and then have the Red Lotus jet and that's it. Like, that's the end. I think I'd still be cool with that if that was the finale.
Yeah, Tanrak is a blunt object. Like, yeah. If we're wondering where Korra has gotten her lack of subtlety from, it's right here. There's no mystery there. Well, my favorite scene was Bolin lava bending because of the music and what he does, and I love that he doesn't think he's gonna survive that. I don't think. You know, I mean, he just charges in to try and buy everyone else more time. And that could have ended really horribly and tragically. And it just happens that he's a lava bender.
Bolin is slowly, I know that I'm supposed to really love Bumi, and I do. I love Bumi. But Bolin is like easily my favorite character of this.
Are we going to see a lot more Bolin gifts past Korra?
What do you want to say?
Like on Tumblr, like Bumi. Like old Bumi and Bolin, those would be your like your go-tos for your gifts for reactions.
Oh yeah, I mean there's plenty of like good Bumi gifts, Bumi 2.0 as I like to call him, gifts that I've started to come across. Really good, like him falling down a mountain and you know dancing with the little spirit guy.
Well, back to your favorite scene, Nicole. I almost feel like we're meant to understand he dies there for just a hot second. Pun intended, because of the way he like screams and is covered by the lava crest, and then you see him like undo it, and it's like, ah, like I would have also understood, I think, maybe this is sad, if like if at least Bolin died or something, like trying to protect them.
Trying to kill off people.
Well, just no one, it makes me kind of sad that like none of the main cast dies in these episodes. I wish that one did. I think that would have carried the story, but I won't harp that point too much.
Yeah, so moving on to favorite lines. Karen, what was yours?
My favorite line was when Korra said, "Help me save the airbenders, then you can worry about saving me." I thought it was such a beautiful line because she just knows. She's like, I might not come out of this, but I still have to do my job. And it was just this ultimate, like, we don't have time to talk about this. We don't have time to figure something else out. We're limited, and this is just what's going to have to happen. And I like that everybody else was like, okay, we're going to follow your lead.
Well, they're also like, we're not going to follow your plan at all. But yeah, they were like, we're going to follow. Yeah, no, I agree. And that was, it's amazing to see Korra, like, when kind of the rubber hits the pavement, and she is completely there. Brittany, how about you? This is a really dark one.
As per usual, I picked the funny side comment as my line. And it's when Zaheer like flies by the airship And Kazan looks out the window and he's like, well, I guess he doesn't need a ride. Because he just like flies past them. It's so funny.
I appreciate Kazan's sass. He's such a sass master that it's almost sad to see him go eventually. It's like, no, like I really could have used your attitude around. It's fun.
I forgot how much I liked Kazan. He's a great character. Mitchell, what's your favorite line?
Oh, the feels. Mine is when Lin goes, come and get me, you third-eyed freak, and she's jumping in front of Pali's fire. You see this reaction on Pali's face, and it's such an intense line, the way that Ariana's best friend does it. It's just, oh, it gets me.
Yeah, and what she says right before that is, I love you, to Sue, which is, you know.
Oh, I know. It's good. And I really thought, okay, she tried to sacrifice herself in book one, and then she's doing it again in book three. You can't get away with that too many more times.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I feel like any little kid, like Mike and Brian, gave like all the like children who have like less awareness of tropes and stuff watching this like multiple heart attacks watching these episodes.
Yeah.
My favorite line is not a new one, but I love it. I don't think I got to call it out on Rewatchable. Let go your earthly tether, enter the void and become wind. And I love how that repeats. And like Brittany said, how it kind of finally comes to take on this new meaning. And yeah, I love it.
And I love the Edge of the Void beat. I think it's just so simple and beautiful. I don't know what it is about it, but it really gets me.
Yeah. All right. Chapter 13, Venom of the Red Lotus, literally. In this episode, Cora faces horrific hallucinations as the metal-bent poison sets in. After finally succumbing to the Avatar state, all hell breaks loose as Cora uses fire jet propulsion to chase after Zaheer. Meanwhile, Mako electrocutes Minghua finally, and Kazan commits suicide. Damn, Brike. Seriously. In an epic finale, the airbenders escape their imprisonment and form a giant cyclone to trap Zaheer just in the nick of time. Sue is able to revive Cora, and Balin pulls a Sokka, making Zaheer put a Sokka in it. In the epilogue, Asami helps a wheelchair-bound Cora prepare for Jinora's airbending master ceremony and tells the Avatar she'll always be there for her if she needs anything. President Raiko, who is a bleep, welcomes Cora back into Republic City and expresses concern that the world will be in even more peril with a disabled Avatar because he's a bleep. At the ceremony, Tenzin vows to lead his newfound air nation in protecting the world as Cora recuperates. Jinora's bald head and arrow tattoos are unveiled, revealing an uncanny likeness to her grandpa Aang. And Cora watches this beautiful ceremony and a single tear goes down her face as we all feel that a lot.
Oh, come on, I can't. I'm going to cry right now. I can't.
It's hugely emotional. And, like, I remember watching this and being like, that's it? What? Like, oh, I'm sorry.
How heartbreaking was that moment?
Oh, my gosh. It was so, it was crazy. Yeah. Well, we'll talk about the end when we get there. But, yeah, Cora's hallucinations. Let's start off with this.
I thought this whole thing was really weird. Like, there's so much going on that it was one of those episodes. Sometimes, like, full disclosure on my part, I, like, will listen to what's going on while doing other things. But this episode, I was like, what?
Rewatchable, guys. We take this super serious.
Well, because some episodes, especially more so book two, I would put it on and I'd be like, all right, when I start not hearing dialogue, I'll start watching because I know that they're bending.
That's probably okay. book two, at least.
I got the gist. But this episode, this morning, I was just so into it. Like, the hallucinations were probably, that would be something I would have like written off had it happened in season two, because I was just so frustrated with everything that was going on, but they just made perfect sense here and they were so cool. And, you know, you got all of the enemies coming back and it just, this whole, the storytelling in these two episodes was just so rewarding as a fan of this series. So I was really into it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, I mean, I will agree that, there's definitely stuff you cannot pay attention to in season two, but this season kind of pulls you back in.
Yeah.
And I will say season four, people have mixed feelings about season four, but you really need to pay attention in terms of the psychology of what's going on. And there's a lot of mind games that are being played, and you kind of need to watch people's expressions and things, because that comes in. Cora experiences these horrible hallucinations and basically kind of ends up, you know, what I don't know if everybody has this interpretation, but what screamed out to me in this, right, is that Cora is trying to die before she enters the Avatar state.
Yes.
Right?
I'm with you. Let go. And she's like, I'm not going to let go. I'm going to let go.
Yeah. And like, because their plan is to put her in the Avatar state so she dies in the Avatar state and kills the Avatar. You know, you have this whole line, like, you will be the last, you know, Korra, the last Avatar. And she's like, I can't let that happen. Like, she is physically trying to die before the Avatar state can be killed, which is metal as bleep.
You know, it makes me wonder if she couldn't have done something, though. She really wanted to kill herself, because she still has, like, firebending breath. It'd be kind of horrific, but she could, like, what, I don't know, light herself on fire or just something. Like, I feel like there's some way she could have really killed herself if she wanted to. I think it crossed her mind. She was terrified of it. And I think that now that we know of Rava was, you know, saying to Cora in my own headcanon, like, we can continue. We can fight this. Don't worry. I'll get you through this. And that, I mean, it seems like there was like a conflict of like Cora's, I kind of want to die, and of Rava's, no, turn into me and we'll fight them.
And then Nickelodeon executives being like, no, sorry, we have some standards. You can't kill yourself.
Yeah. Can you not, though? Can you not, Brittany?
Television.
Or can, but that would have been, I didn't pick up on that, to be completely honest.
It's more of a subtle note. It really
is. Yeah, but that's really interesting, and it adds something like really cool to this, especially because of where we leave Cora at the end of this episode. She's had it. That adds a lot more to the stakes of her like emotional stability. Like, oh, like 2 weeks ago, I tried to kill myself before, like, you know, like I was willing to just die at that moment. And now she's like kind of back and having to get back into everything. So that's good to know.
Yeah, and I'm also, I don't think, as much as I love like dark headcanons and stuff, I don't always think you have to go to the darkest interpretation. But to me, this isn't, it's almost not a dark interpretation. It's the only sensible one in my thought process, just because like there's nothing else for her to do. Like, I don't actually think she can really bend herself to death. And I think she's also probably extremely distracted by the massive physical pain that she's in. But you know, plus the effort of fighting the Avatar state, which is crazy.
I think you make a good point that this isn't even the most dark interpretation you can go. Well, maybe it is, but I think it's the interpretation to go, because of the fact that if she went into the Avatar state earlier, I think at least Rava knew, or Cora might have half known, that she'd be able to fight them off in a stronger state. I think, though, it's weird that Cora, it does seem to kind of give up, though. You're right. She does, from the fact that she's fighting off the Avatar state, does seem to give up. And it's, on the face, it seems like, oh, she just doesn't want the Avatar cycle to end. It's like, no, she doesn't want to fight anymore. She's too tired.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's both. I think she can't, I think actually letting the Avatar state end is her biggest fear, I think. In my opinion. And I think that's part of why, you know, I mean, it's been a theme throughout the whole series, right? Her intense connection to being the Avatar, how she defines herself by being the Avatar, and literally always has. And that was part of, you know, going back to season one, why Aman was such a freaking, you know, terrifying threat to her, and why that was so horrifying. And you know, whether or not you interpret her a little, like, I don't know, I don't remember if this was discussed on here, but a lot of people interpreted her standing on the edge of that cliff being like, you know, maybe I should die because I'm not the right Avatar. You know, I'm not going to be good for the world. And that really, if you read it that way, comes back in like a hammer, and like, you know, Tonrak's ice fist, like in this episode, on her psyche.
And I wouldn't put that past break at all. I think that they often do that. They know what the censorship rules are for the network, and then they also know that they don't want to crush their fans. So I think if they have an idea, they kind of half commit to it, like have Cora stand on an edge, but don't don't have like a shot of her putting her foot over it, right? But they let you fill in that blank on purpose, like I said, both for censorship, but also because I think it's more poetic in the ways that they're able to not, like, you know, spoon feed you every bit of darkness that this show has to offer. And plus, I'm assuming that that's the only way they can put this kind of stuff in, because imagine if Cora's foot was starting to go off that cliff, like the uprise, the show wouldn't have a season 2. It would not. I know it wouldn't.
Yeah, well, I agree. And I think that, it is more elegant this way. You know, leaving things up to interpretation is usually a good call in storytelling. I'm just going to like rub my nails on my MFA jacket and like look really cool right there. So this doesn't work because Gazan, because Zaheer, it's the Z. This is the Z sound that's messing me up. Zaheer was totally not aware of how powerful the Avatar State is.
He's like, you know what? No big deal. We'll just put her in this like state where she's like basically leveling up times 1,000 and I'll just kill her.
Exactly.
These chains are fine.
It will totally work.
It's essentially the definition of Korra going full Dragon Ball Z.
Yeah. I guess I haven't seen Dragon Ball Z, but if you think about it, that kind of, it's very appropriate, right? Because he really thinks that he ultimately is more powerful, you know, like maybe not bending wise, but he thinks he has more power than Korra does. And that is why his philosophy of anarchy is right and will be destined to succeed, you know? And so it makes sense. Like, he's like, yeah, I totally accounted for her strength. And now we're just going to totally just kill her while she's hanging here, you know? And so I kind of like that he's sort of, you know, taken down by his own wrongness, really. So Korra breaks out and starts one of the most insane fights. I think the most insane fight we've ever seen, because Korra is not Korra in this. She is pure Rava, pure Avatar of Vengeance. And it's all her against Zaheer. And she does jet propulsion. She's just like, she also has very little concern for her physical body in this fight, which is scary. You know, she gets beat up a lot and she just kind of keeps getting up and, you know, with those glowy eyes, it's like, it's really, really intense. And so Karen, let us know what your thoughts were on this.
Yeah, this actually really worried me because it was so violent and they're just smashing through all these rock formations, and you want her to be in the Avatar state because she's stronger that way and you want her to defeat Zaheer. But at the same time, you're like, be careful, don't get too close, because if he kills her in that state, then it's all over. And it was really, it sort of tugged on you because you weren't sure which way you wanted. I mean, obviously you don't want Korra to die, but you didn't know what you wanted to happen exactly, because if she was left in her normal human body, like without being in the Avatar state, she was really weak. But that the Avatar state is kind of a scary thing. I mean, we saw that in Avatar when he goes into it the first couple of times and doesn't necessarily have a lot of control over it. It's very powerful, almost too powerful even for the Avatar. And it's a little scary to watch.
Yeah, agreed. It is intense. So down on Earth, I guess, while this is happening, first of all, the airbenders are all kind of trapped. They're being held prisoner and, they are then freed by, Tenzin and Lin and Sami and that group of people. Mako and Bolin go in to take out, and I mean, Tenzin would have gone too, but he's almost dead, go to take out or to try and save Korra in the underground area, which puts them right up against Gazan and Ming Hua. So this gets even darker because Mako and Ming Hua, you know, finally have their, you know, showdown, and which ends with Mako electrocuting Ming Hua to death. There was a debate for a while about whether she was actually dead, but yeah, she did. He straight up kills her, Which is, that's not a comment against Mako. It's just like, whoa, okay. Bolin can't actually quite defeat Gazan, but Gazan sees the writing on the wall and decides to take everyone down with him. So, Bolin and Mako manage to escape. So he kills himself. And we were like, oh, this episode isn't dark enough. We need Tenzin to die. Like, what the heck, guys? This is insane. Sort of when you're watching it, you're sort of like, oh, wow, that's really dark. And then you talk about it and it's like, oh, my God, how did they like write out this episode? Like, yeah. Did they just have like little like use tiny print to get this past Nickelodeon? Like, don't worry about that. That part's not important.
They're like, distract you with awesome bending, awesome bending, awesome bending. Oh, exactly. You didn't catch that? Oh, it's already on. Well, this was what, online by this point?
Yeah.
I'm almost surprised that Nickelodeon didn't like put out like a more censorship version of at least this episode after to like see, wow, we let that out. Like, we should probably reel it back in.
Well, yeah. If this was going online, I think that kind of changes the game a little bit too. It's not being played in rerun form on Nickelodeon when anyone like, 7 and under can see it. So it's kind of
imagine a 7-year-old watching this episode.
If I was a 7-year-old watching this episode, I would be like, I strive to be Mako and electrocute the crap out of everyone. Like, I would have been reenacting that in my pool. I would have been like, you all are dead. Because that's what I used to do, guys.
I mean, I think kids can handle more than we give them credit for sure. But I do think that this, and I think it does replay in reruns sometimes.
Yeah, it does. They did air it on TV too. Every episode aired on TV, at least from season 3, afterwards, because they like wait a week or something weird. It was just so strange. Sometimes they grouped them together out of order.
So Nickelodeon, yeah, it doesn't make sense. It does make you think, like, if the, like, starting with the Earth Queen stuff, it kind of makes you wonder if that was why they were like, this is totally going to air first online, and like, well, the people who want it can find it.
Which, you know what, at the end of the day, it was true, and it probably made the show better. It was just upsetting because we wanted the show to do well, not to make it better, and that's, I think, I mean, there's a weird balance there, so.
Well, it also, it felt very invalidating for the show, because, like, If it had been from the beginning, like, okay, Korra is kind of experimental for Nickelodeon, and it's gonna, it's aimed at older people, so we're gonna put it online, like that, everybody would have been fine with that. But the fact that it wasn't a TV show airing on TV, and then literally halfway through season 3, they were randomly like, and now the episodes are gonna be online, it was... which is, I mean, they did a similar thing with, apparently it was tied into the fact that when they put the season 2 finale online, which Mike and Brian didn't want them to do, I think, they put that online first before it aired, and it got like a ton of hits. I mean, it did incredibly well. So I think from what I remember hearing, the execs were like, okay, people actually will watch this online, so let's just put it online. I don't know why it was like halfway through season 3. I mean, season 3 was like a cluster beep. It really was, with like the episodes airing in different, like they were airing like 2 at a time, and they were sort of off, like the off episodes. And it was an absolute mess, which was, funny considering what an amazing season it is. That's a conversation that's been had at length, I'm sure.
And didn't we have the announcement in the airing of book 4 maybe as much as 3 months after? Like, it was close.
Yes, it was. It was very close.
Like, announcement and release within like a week. Done.
This season started on like in September. And so I guess it ended around December time. And then, that doesn't make sense. I don't remember, but Korra season 4 started in like September also. And it was, basically we didn't have a Comic-Con in between. Like, it was season 3 talked about at Comic-Con, and then season 4 aired before we had like a convention to discuss it at. Yeah, whatever it was, there wasn't a ton of time between, which was also shocking because of, you know, the wait that had been for season two. I don't know. Korra was a massive journey. I think in every sense of the word for everyone involved, and I was kind of crazy. But speaking of craziness, so we have our most of our bad guys dead, and Jinora basically comes up with the solution of what to do with about Gazan, and she kind of realizes, and I think it, you know, I don't know about like practically, but thematically it certainly works for this season, that this is the first time that there have been this many airbenders in one place in a long time who are capable of doing something. So they all work together and create a massive cyclone to suck Zaheer back to Earth, basically. And Korra as well. And she basically, I guess I just want to ask, like, does anyone have any thoughts about the bad guys being dead?
I mean, I'm sad, but I like that there's still a threat of, you know, Zaheer still around. So I liked that part of it, but I really enjoyed these villains, but I kind of knew that they had to go at some point, and it would have been weird to have them in prison again. So I'm sad to see them go, but at the same time, I get it. Like, you can't have season four be season three again, you know?
Yeah. Yeah,
basically same. I am sad to see them go because they were such good villains and their bending was beautiful, but you kind of needed that like definite conclusion to their story, I think.
Yeah. Because if this stayed around, like, this would never end. We would still have Red Lotus stuff going on. I think with like this four, you know, like we needed to have some kind of conclusion, I think, at least with these dangerous benders. And it's, I still have problems with the fact that Gazan didn't try harder against the Fire Fairy brothers, because I feel like it almost feels like they were like, oh, we need to get rid of Gazan quick, make him weaker and done. Because I still think he could have fought them off. I still think Gazan could have survived that fight.
He could have. I wonder how much of it was affected by the fact that Pali and Ming-Hwa were now dead and Zaheer was all fighting a superpowered avatar. You know, I think it might have been part of like seeing the writing on the wall for himself and just not, I don't know. I mean, he's not the smartest guy, right? So I can like explain it to myself. I don't know, I really like Gazan. I kind of wish he had kind of survived and maybe had the chance to be like, oh, like maybe that wasn't such a nice thing I did. Like maybe I should go and like help rebuild Ba Sing Se or something, even though he's too powerful because he can make lava at any given time. Yeah, these people are all like too powerful to have around pretty much, which is ridiculous if you think about it. But Korra is brought crashing back to Earth, and Zaheer is finally trapped by the airbenders and Bolin. And Korra is basically dying in her father's arms until Jinora realizes, luckily, and a little belatedly, that the poison...
Deus Ex Jinora times two.
Yeah, a little bit. That the poison is metal, so Sue metal bends it out, but I really wish it had been Sue and Lin, you know, like, working together. I don't know why Lin was just like, I'm just gonna stay here.
It should have been just Lin, if anything.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Brittany.
Oh, no, I was just saying that I really wanted it to be both of them.
Yeah, well,
if anything,
I mean,
wouldn't it have felt better if it was just Lin? Like, if we're going to choose just one person, who does she have a closer attachment to?
Yeah, I mean, I guess Sue is more of an artistic metalbender in that way. Like, she does that whole dancey stuff, and her son is an artist, I guess, but... I mean, I see why she would be maybe more more suited for this than Lin would, but I still, I don't know. They don't put too fine of a point on it, so it is kind of strange that like it's Sue who we've just met, and you know she's cool, but like we definitely have mixed feelings about her, and that she's the one who does this. I don't know. Karen and Brittany, I'm interested in kind of how you felt about this whole end, and like what you thought was going to happen, because Cora is basically like inches away. Shit. This is her her season two of, you know, La Pieta, like Aang in Katara's arms as she like carries him away, and it's like, oh my god, he's dead. He's so dead. He is totally dead. Which I think canonically he was, actually. Why the Avatar didn't get reborn is its own little issue there, but
I think it's, I remember we were talking about that, and I was like, I wonder if all the past Avatars are just sitting around, like, deliberating, like, oh, come on, we need to pick a new one already? Like, we didn't expect to have to do this so quick. Oh, like, quick, yeah, just, Katara? No, she's already, no.
when they reconvened, they didn't have quorum, so they, like, couldn't actually vote, because they wouldn't have a majority, so they were just like, well, he's alive.
Right, yeah.
We'll reconvene, like,
can we make UA? Nope, not her.
In 70 Magic years. Spirit water? Okay, cool.
Yeah.
So Brittany, how did you feel about this conclusion or this climax, I guess?
I don't know. I mean, I really thought, like I've said 100 times, like these whole two episodes were really rewarding. But at the same time, it is a finale, so like things had to wrap up at some point. But I would have liked it to have gone on longer. Like, I wish book 3 was like 22 episodes. You know what I mean? And this was like a mid-season finale. Like, we could have amped up the story a little bit more and like gone really deeper into this. But I liked the ending. I don't know what else to say. I wanted this to go on for a lot longer than it did.
Yeah. And did you think there was a potential that Korra would die there?
No, only because, you know, we have book 4 and
right.
He's there. I think that's the problem. Like, if I was watching it without any knowledge of book 4, absolutely.
Cool, cool. Yeah, no, it's one of those things where, I don't know, they do kind of, for me, like, when the show is really good, it sort of disconnects me from my awareness of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, I mean, you obviously know that we've all seen season 4.
Yeah.
so I guess with us, it was more like, could season 4 be something completely different? Like, we didn't really know, you know. But yeah. And Karen, any thoughts on this little craziness here?
I really appreciated how they did this kind of altogether. I didn't think Korra was going to die, probably for the same reasons, you know, Brittany's talking about, is like, I knew book 4 was coming and everything, but the fact that she got seriously injured at the end of this, I mean, she ends up in a wheelchair, was huge for me, because it's so realistic. We were talking about that fight and how violent it was and how she had no regard for her physical body, and she's just slamming through all of these rock formations. You know, she can't just get up from that. And I really appreciated the fact that they decided to take her to that place, because for the Avatar, for the person who has to save the world, to be wheelchair bound is, and essentially not being able to bend, I would assume, is extremely difficult. I mean, how do you sort of live with yourself after that? You must feel like you don't have any purpose. And I'm really excited to see her struggle with that in book 4. Hopefully it's not, you know, an easy recovery or an instant recovery in episode 1 or something like that.
Now, I just hope that no one's spoiled with, like, images on Hypeable of what happens now, because I'm excited if you don't know anything, because I think that there's a really cool story to tell, and it's sad if you're spoiled by anything in book 4. So without saying what you know, do you know anything, Brittany or Karen, about, like, anything in book 4, or is it completely blank?
Besides the finale, final moment.
Right.
And
okay.
One other thing.
Yes, I know what thing you're talking about. All right.
I'm fine. Like,
that's cool. That's really cool.
Yeah, hashtag the thing. And then also a character. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay.
Well, maybe to address the character, I don't know if this is what you were talking about, but there is a moment here when Kuvira, this woman, she's the one who saves Tonrak. And she's kind of like, they had a little conversation. She's like, you can call me Kuvira. And I remember the first time I watched it, I was like, what? Why? Why would we do that? You're a random person in the background. Did you guys, Karen and Brittany, think anything of that? Or do you find it weird? Or do you know what's coming? And this it really isn't a major spoiler. It is, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a major spoiler.
I mean, her character was not the character I was referring to. But when that did happen, my, like, Azula sensors went up, like, when I was watching
Aang
Kai. Oh, my
gosh,
Kai,
you didn't just say
that.
And I
was like,
I love
who's
you.
That person that they're focusing on her face? And she has no relevance in this story. And then it was Azula later on. But, yeah, I definitely was like, okay, she's clearly going to be important. But, yeah, she was not what I was referring to.
Okay, cool.
Me neither.
Oh, I feel like I know what you
It was about. Actually an article that you wrote while we were watching Avatar, Mikal, that spoiled it for me by accident. I just happened to be in the image gallery on Hyperbole doing things, and I was like, what? Because it like comes up in the Twitter feed too, so I was like,
right. Oh, wow.
Yeah. That has
completely
right
unintentional
now.
Spoil, yeah. But because we were only in like book three or no, we were maybe in like book two of Avatar at the time, so.
Well,
that makes me happy because I think that season four deserves to be seen as much as it could possibly be like blank. Like I loved going in not knowing anything. I think that what Karen and Brittany know right now is pretty much, except for hashtag the thing, what I knew. Maybe a little bit more. Maybe they knew a little bit more. But I think that there's a lot that you're really going to enjoy. And I think that the show is going to make you really happy in some points and make you really angry at some points. That's all I'm going to say there, I guess.
I guess I'll say that I think that season four is, I think season one is the most cohesive, because one episode really just like storms into the next in that season. And I don't think the show has quite reached that level since, but I think that season four is one of the most cohesive. I think season three is awesome, and I think there are amazing episodes that really do bleed into each other, especially toward the end. But there are, you know, times when we go and have like the airbenders and whatever, all this stuff. But season four really is concerned mostly with one thing, and it's kind of spectacular. I'm a big fan. Not everyone loved it, but I don't know. I really, really enjoyed it.
And you know, there's another interesting thing here too that we should note, just in terms of cast. Zelda Williams was very public about the fact that she was playing Quivira in season three and excited to do that. And it's really fun that she wanted to do that too, because I mean, this was, not to get too feelsy, I think she was recording season three right before her father's passing. So it's kind of sad if you think about it in that context. But you can almost feel like, you know, she's carrying on a legacy in a certain way by like continuing to perform, I suppose, or whatnot. So it makes me happy that she's doing it. I'm sure we'll talk a lot more in the future about voice actors and whatnot to come in season four.
Yeah. I forgot she was doing that. That makes me so excited, because Teen Wolf represent. I mean,
Yeah.
She's done a lot of other things, a lot bigger things, but that's where I kind of fell in love with her, because she's a really cool human being.
Yeah, she is.
I just love that her name is named after... Mm-hmm. Legend of Zelda. That's just, yes, I agree, Robin Williams. I agree.
I love her voice, personally. Like, she's got that, like, huskiness to it. It's awesome. I love it.
So sultry, though. It's just, yeah. Oh.
Yeah. I really like season four. Anyway, okay. At the end of season three, Korra is wheelchair bound, and Asami helps her get ready for her, I guess, her first kind of public appearance since this has happened about 2 weeks ago. And which is actually the sign of things to come, and if you know what I'm talking about. But what did you guys think of this scene with, you know, it's 2 weeks later, Korra looks like crap emotionally. She's like barely talking. She looks exhausted, and she's in a wheelchair. So I know, Brittany, you said that it was really great that there were consequences, but how did you feel about the emotional consequences?
I really appreciated it, because Korra, for a while, like at the end of book one and book two, it's sort of just like, oh, well, haha, I listened to, you know, Unalaq 100 times and now the world is in disarray. Or like, she kind of just like, she's been such a frustrating character for me to even try to like. Like, I just don't want to put any investment in her. Which is horrible to say because it's the legend of Korra, but she's been so disappointing as a character, being just like, well, I'm the Avatar, like, and then it just becomes, well, I don't want to do that, even though I'm the Avatar. So with this, I feel like she finally is accepting the burdens that she has to, and there is a huge emotional like consequence to that, and you can really see how much it's weighing on her, and I really, really am enjoying that character development. I know she's in like this really depressive state, which is awful, but it's rewarding to see her go there for the purpose of the story. So I like that it's been 2 weeks and she's not just like, okay, back to action. Like, she is like, there's going to have to be someone or something that happens to get her out of the funk. And I'm excited to see what that is, like what finally charges her and gets her into like, not, she's not going to go back. I don't feel like she's going to go back to the Korra that I didn't like in the past couple seasons. So I'm excited about that. Like, I don't think that she's going to have a complete regression. Like, she's going to move forward, but this is always going to weigh on her.
Mm-hmm. Well, in a way, what you're saying, Brittany, reminds me of a thought that I had when I first saw her in a wheelchair. I just said, you know what, Korra, you've earned this. Like, you've that's a very weird thing to say, that you've earned like a disability or being injured. But you've earned, I guess, the break. You've earned the right to have your pity party, because you deserve to be able to recover from, you know, the horrors of being treated as not a human being, as a puppet that needs to be killed just because of what you are. And that enough, with all of the, you know, injury and whatnot, is enough to break your spirit and to make you feel, I mean, even in the fact that she defined herself as I am the Avatar, you know, whatever else, the fact that being an Avatar maybe isn't even a good thing anymore. Maybe that's too much of a threat to even live a life. And I love that that is crushing on Korra, because it allows her to get to a place that I don't think we would have seen if this didn't all happen to her. She would have just been still a little bit obnoxious. And here we just see like this really subtle version of her. And it's like, it's very sobering, I think, at the end of the show, to see this very, like, you know, stone-faced Korra that is just so over this. She's done. She does not care about anything going on. Not even Jinora's master ceremony. She's just like, all right, cool. Well, I guess we'll do this now.
I wanna say that I don't think that and I don't think anyone's saying this, but I want to note that I don't think you like your characters don't have to suffer to make up for things that they've done, and I don't think like that like Korra quote unquote deserves this because she's been like too you know, brash or whatever in the past, and I don't think that the show is treating it like that, but I think
no.
It can be rewarding to see your favorite characters go through some really tough times that they feel unequipped to deal with. Like, I'm dealing with this right now on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., if anyone has been watching that. And, like, I kind of actually see sort of a similar thing between, like, almost a similarity in expression between, like, Agent Simmons and Korra. Like, what they've kind of got going on in their faces just because of, you know, the trauma that they've experienced. So, yeah.
I should say, because it's been a running trend with me every week to hate on Korra. I don't by any means think that she deserves where she is. I just think it's a good place that they took her for the purpose of character development. I don't think this is like karma coming back to get her and like, yes, Korra, you deserve to do anything. I don't think that at all. Because I feel like people who listen and have heard me talk about Korra as a person would probably infer that I think that, but I don't.
And it's like, you know, okay, yeah, we didn't kill off a main cast member, but at least we have, you know, Korra still suffering from the fact that she was, you know, whatever, tortured and beaten to a bloody pulp and nearly suffocated. Like, that is still satiating to me, not satisfying, but it just fills that need to see her finally need to recover from one of these big final fights. She usually just seems to just jump right back and have some kind of deus ex machina get her back to where she needs to be. But this time around, because you think about it, it was, you know, she got back her bending from Aang's spirit in book one. Book two, she got back the Avatar spirit, which kind of broke her, but this one is just, no, like, you are disabled in a wheelchair. There's no quick fix to that.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. So we also get a truly stunning, well, we get President Ryko being a bleep because he is just the worst. And he's like, oh, well, this avatar that I've been, like, crapping on for this whole time, like, is suddenly not able to be the avatar, and I'm really worried about that. And it's like, I hate you, you idiot. But that does ring a bell for Tenzin, who later says that he and the Airbenders will take on Korra's role as the default protector of the world.
You know, if anyone had to say it, I'd rather be the person that we already don't like.
I guess. But I didn't. Yeah, whatever. It was such a whatever. But in the meantime, we get like a scene that is just like, for all like the horror and craziness and awfulness that we've experienced just now, equally as stunning and beautiful and moving and completely earned. And Jinora gets her airbender tattoos, and there's music, and she looks just like Aang without her hair, and it's like, oh my god, it's like I really had a moment every time I watched that. I was like, oh my god, it's Aang, you know, with the tattoos and everything. And then, you know, obviously it's not, but I'm tearing up a little bit, guys. I think this is a really beautiful, stunningly beautiful connective moment between Avatar and Korra, and I'm just such a big fan. Karen, what did you feel about this?
Yeah, it was beautiful, and I, like you said, just so deserving. I'm so glad they finally went there, because Jinora has been sort of a solid presence since we've met her. Very level-headed, very intelligent, very kind and generous, and she, I think, embodies the spirit of an airbender so completely, and the fact that her father didn't want her to take this final step for a while was very frustrating, because we knew that she was more than capable of handling it, and now that we're here, it's just so gratifying to see her be able to take on that title.
Yeah, for sure. Brittany, how about you?
I really loved the entire ceremony aspect of it. I think it was a great way to wrap up the season, to have this like beautiful moment of like, you know, coming together, sort of like in movies, like where like, you know, you go to a christening or something, or you go to like a wedding, like, you know, it's just that moment where like everything that has happened just is sort of like, you kind of let it go for a minute and you focus on something that's like truly like great and wonderful. And it's great for everyone. It gives them a break. It allows them to see like the whole community coming together, and everyone was in all their like nice airbender outfits, and Jinora looked so great, and Tenzin was so proud, and it was a really cool moment to watch, as like, you know, you have your team Avatar kind of off to the side of the stage, but just to see the presence of all of those airbenders, and it's like it's the start of the new like airbender nation, and it's really cool.
Yeah. And I also tend to think, like, I know it was frustrating for a lot of people that Tenzin didn't want Jinora to get her tattoos, but I feel like by asking for them, she was almost like proving that she wasn't ready. And obviously we don't know, but just my personal headcanon is that like after all this and whatever, like Tenzin just came over to her and was like, okay, so here's how we start your tattoo process. And she was just like, what, dad? And he's like, okay, you're becoming a master now, you know, because I don't know, it's just my silly little headcanon. But I think that, you know, this was so earned in that, like, it was so obvious and so, you know, and involved so much leadership on her part. It wasn't just like doing a cool airbender move, even though obviously what she does in season two is incredible and self-sacrificing and an amazing thing. Even if it is weird and overpowered and whatever. But this was just like every element of her, you know, stepping forward into the responsibility of being an airbender. Yeah, I loved it. Let's just leave off thoughts on Korra in terms of kind of what that tear means. And if you think she might be okay going forward, Mitchell, do you remember any of your thoughts?
Here's the horrible part about this all. There wasn't really a chance to recuperate or separate from season 3 and 4. So I don't invest very well into Cora's wheelchair story because I already know how it ends so quickly. I see the resolution as soon as I see the conflict, and that's a very sad thing. And I wish I had more time to breathe between these seasons. And I wish I had a better answer for you too, but it's just really how it goes.
Yeah. I mean, I know for me, I was just, and still am, kind of thrown by that. You know, it's we don't see Cora cry, like, ever, you know, and, you know, which is ironic because we saw Aang cry all the time. You know, like, our male hero was, like, the weepiest, you know, kid we've
ever met. He was, like, 12.
I know, and I'm not saying it's bad. I think male heroes should be able to cry, absolutely. But Cora has been this stoic, you know, like, she's just not somebody, like, even when she thinks her father's dead, she doesn't cry, she tries to take revenge on you know, and this is just such a drastically different thing for her. I remember, like, scrambling almost for, like, a logical explanation and being like, oh, but it's gonna be fine, right? Like, it's all gonna be okay. Yeah, Karen Brittany, any last thoughts?
I'm kind of excited for season 4, not gonna lie.
You should be. And I also think that we should all give silent claps to Janet Varney for excellent performances, Cora, in book 3 especially. She blew me out of the water with her reactions, most of, not even her lines, but just the way that she, you know, feels. Like, I feel like Cora is a real person even more from the fact that I can love a voice actress like her as much.
Yeah. Yeah, she was at New York Comic Con, but I didn't have time to go get her autograph. So if we're all done, any last thoughts on season 3?
Glad it picked up from season 2, even though, yeah, I didn't hate season 2, like a lot of people did, but such a huge difference between the two definitely makes me excited for season 4 and makes me a little scared. I hope I like it as much.
I loved all the bending forever. I might just, like, rewatch these 2 episodes again just for the bending. It's so good.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't blame you.
Like, lightning bolt electrocution. Oh, my God. It's so pretty.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. Okay, so let's move on to our favorite scenes. Karen, what was yours?
Mine was Sami taking care of Cora at the end, just because I really like the fact that these two are friends and that they're close, and it you know, Mako hasn't come between them or anything like that, and it's just two girls being friends, and, you know, Asami wanting to take care of Cora and Cora letting her. I mean, I don't think she really has much of a choice, but she could have been a lot more stubborn about it, and I feel like season 1 Cora would have been. I think that's my favorite thing about how this ended, is that season 1 Cora kind of thought the world owed her, and this Cora is taking it, maybe not necessarily in stride because she's very upset about what's going on, but I just feel like this is a completely different person from the Avatar that we met in season 1 that I think took us all a while to kind of start appreciating.
Yeah. Yeah, agreed. Yeah, and that's a beautiful scene, right? I agree. Like, that Cora is, I mean, I think she could have said, like, go away, Asami. I'm not going to this thing, or I don't
exactly
want you to make me look good. But yeah, and that Asami cares that much, that she, like, she, you know, I don't know that, like, looking good maybe does this, like, people react differently. Like, some people really feel, they feel depending on how they look, you know, and I think Asami probably is one of those people. I don't think Cora is, but Asami really wants to help Cora feel better, and, like, the way she can, I think, is just lovely. Brittany, what was your favorite scene?
Mine was Bolin's, like, whole entire fight sequence, because he can lava bend now, he doesn't rely on it. He sticks to his, like, earth bending a lot more than the lava bending. And I've appreciated that about his character. Plus, I just love watching him earth bend. So I was into it.
Yeah. And it was cool that Kazan was like, oh, cool.
Yeah, like he was sort of like, he like went from like enemy to like almost like quasi mentor in that moment. He was just like sort of like, oh, like I'm basically, he's like saying like, I'm a master and you're a novice, but like, this is kind of cool. Like, I want to see how far I could push you. Not, I mean, he did want to kill him, but at the same time, he was like really appreciating the fact that he could hold his own against him.
Yeah, for sure. There's,
that makes it all the more jarring that I think Azan decides to kill himself. It's like, you finally have a protege. You can teach him, be a good guy or something. And then it's like, I'm going to go to jail, so bye.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I don't know that I buy it. I kind of wish he tried to escape, but, like, I don't see him getting any kind of pardon. I don't see them being, like, letting him lava bend, you know? Like, he's gone way too far in this, like, There are other characters later on that I have different feelings on, but I think Gazan is not. It makes me really, really depressed, but I don't think Gazan would have had a future with lava bending or teaching Lilin or anything.
Why doesn't he just escape and like form a new identity? It's so easy in this non-internet world to do that. So like, just bury a hole. You're an earthbender.
I think they would have tried really hard to find him. I
like
think.
Cut your they're hair. Like,
they're
like,
really,
we had...
really good at making wanted posters in this series.
Well, think about it though. We even had Noah Talk and Tarlok's dad. He had facial reconfiguration surgery. Is that how it's called? So they can still do that in this universe. Like, that's a thing that seems to be fairly common. In the fact that he just did it and it wasn't even like really a big deal. So
Gazan likes the way he looks.
Yeah, and I think he's like so tied to the mission too that it was like, well, what is after this? Like, yeah,
and he's a lot of tattoos. Like, he'd have to wear like tattoo makeup all the time, kind of like where Noah Talk was wearing, you know, his Amon scar makeup all the time too, or Zuko for Britain's Matter.
I still cannot believe that was actually face paint, based on my Zuko face paint comment in season one of Avatar.
Yeah, that was a great moment.
That was so great.
Yeah. Mitch, relatedly, what was your favorite scene?
Okay, I didn't want Ming Hwa to die because I love how insane she is. I love that Grey Delisle is voicing her, because any semblance of Azula that we can get in Korra is a good time for me. But I've been calling for this whole season, and if I was to pretend I was a newbie, I would still be saying this. Why hasn't Mako electrocuted her yet? And it just takes forever for him to figure out that. It's not very difficult. She can't really defend against that, even if she has, like, ice chunks or something. Like, she's done. And she can't redirect it, really. Like, it's so easy to take down a waterbender as a firebender if you can lightning bend. It's like a cinch. Done. Battle over.
Yeah. I don't really like that because it's so violent. It's like... It almost grosses me out, but yeah.
Well, the way she lands too, and she kind of like thud.
Yeah,
so it makes you feel like she's still alive, and she kind of enjoyed it. She was like, "Yes, let's fight again." I don't know, like, you bested me this time, but she's really dead though. It's just it's really disturbing.
She's dead. She is cooked meat, literally. Well, my favorite scene was the reveal of Jenora's tattoos and the bending and all that. Like, basically the final scene. I think it's just gorgeous, and I've been into that. Yeah, that was my favorite. Karen, what was your favorite line?
When Bolin is fighting Gazan, and, you know, they kind of meet up for the first time, and Bolin's just like, well, a lot has changed since then. And he whips out the lava bending, and it's just a beautiful moment.
Yep. Yeah, that's awesome. Brittany, how about you?
Once again, mine was like an aside by one of the guards who, after Jenora kind of like flips up his little uniform skirt thing and gets the keys, and he's just like, I don't know how we ended up here in daycare while everyone else gets to watch the Avatar being destroyed. I can hold a bowl of poison. like they got like the worst jobs of everyone. That's so great.
Yeah, for sure. And that's Steve Bloom, which is funny. He does Amon's voice.
Mitch, that's funny.
Yeah. He has a really distinctive voice. He does a voice in Star Wars Rebels that's like almost completely different, but then they also use him for like all the stormtroopers. And I'm just like, that's Steve Bloom. That's Steve Bloom. There you go. That's Steve Bloom. And it's like just Steve Bloom talking to himself. It's funny.
I'd love to have like Amon talk to Zelda Williams, like those two voices, like Steve Bloom's Amon voice talking with Kuvira. Those are two awesome. I love those voices.
Well, he does have a great moment in season I will say.
He comes back to voice another character?
Maybe.
Okay, I don't remember, so I'm a newbie to that question. Okay.
Okay. Well, what was your favorite line, Mitch?
Mine's when they finally take down Zaheer, and he's, "No, you don't understand. The revolution has already begun. Chaos is the natural order of..." Then Bolin just stuffs a sock in his mouth. You see what I did there? I put a sock in it. Literally.
Bolin's the best.
Yeah, Korra's dying, but let's make a joke. That's cool.
Yeah, and it felt like when they were
I mean, Sokka used to do that too.
Yeah,
Sokka did do that. He did that to Ozai when they finally had him trapped. They're like, king of not like winning things. Ha 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 ha.
Well, my favorite line is when Zaheer says, "And though you will never be reborn, your name will echo throughout history, Korra, the last Avatar." And that's like, okay, let's distill all of her greatest fears into one line. Like, there you go, right there. So we're going to get into some listener feedback right about now. If you guys would like to send us listener feedback, you can email us at rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com. You can comment on Twitter at re_watchable. You can write a message on this post on hypeable.com. And you can reach us on Tumblr. You can also leave us an iTunes review. And if your rate is 5 stars, then Karen will unleash your earthly tether so you can go on fantastical soaring adventures around the world. Does that mean that Karen's going to kill the people you love?
I was just going to ask that.
You know, I'm going to leave that up to interpretation.
Okay, great. all right, so our first listener feedback comes from Twitter. Gordon Toonie Chopperma says, and I actually agree with him, do not watch the season 4 trailer until you have seen episode 2, because spoilers abound. You guys have probably already watched it, right?
No, because I saw this tweet.
Okay, cool.
I retweeted it on the account.
Like, I think I warned you before, Brittany, because you were like, the season 3 one was so great. I was like, do not watch 4.
Yeah, and the reason that you warned me was because I was glad that I watched the season 3 trailer after Zuko came onto the scene, because he's in the trailer a lot.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm like, all right, I know not to watch the trailer.
Yeah. As was Fire Lord Lady. Daughter. Fire Lady Lord Daughter. Yeah.
Karen, you want to take the next one?
Yes, this is from Tabitha Harrison at @it's_like_you_know. Yes, Hamilton Broadway references on Rewatchable. Two of my favorite things. Zuko is Angelica. Katara is Hamilton. Oh, my God. By the way, thoughts on an Alexander-Angelica couple name?
We have to make up a ship name for Hamilton on Rewatchable. This is my favorite day ever.
Yeah.
Alexandrica.
Yeah, Alexandrica.
I do like that. Yeah. I don't. Do you guys agree that Katara is Hamilton?
No, I thought I think I did agree with this, because then that would make Aang Eliza.
I mean, I see it. I guess I wouldn't have thought about that initially because of the genders, but yeah. Yeah, the thing is, Katara is too good to be Hamilton in a way.
Yeah, well, I agree with that. I'm not taking it kind of so far as like personality wise. I just think in the relationship aspect, like, because Zuko does go off, like, you know, with like the man who always pays, you know, someone else. And then there's like Katara, but he's still like in this emotional relationship with Katara, who, like, you know, not necessarily that Katara is going to, like, you know, go and have an affair in the hot streets of New York and then, like, be blackmailed for it and write the Reynolds pamphlet. But,
if Ariana was on this podcast, she would.
Well, the reason this is brought up is she wrote it in the doc last week.
Oh.
And Natalie and I got really into it because we were the only two who could talk about it. But, yeah, I not so much that Katara is Hamilton and, like, every aspect, but just in the way things kind of worked out. I think.
Yeah, I was confused at first because I was like, I don't know if those personalities match up, but I totally get like the relationship thing with like Zuko and Katara and Angelica and Hamilton. Yeah, I'm totally down with that.
Mitch, want to take the next two?
I was going to ask if I could read it because I love, 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 love this username. So Amalia at Picnic with Tea, how cute is that, wrote, after finally finishing #Korra, I'm rewatching #Atla for the first time. Forgot how good it is. Also, it gives me a reason to try at Rewatchable.
Yay! Welcome. If you actually did try Rewatchable.
You'd be surprised. I just had someone that just wrote to me, and I'm not even the podcast manager anymore, so PSA on that. But someone wrote to me, they're like, I can't, Karen, you're gonna be, your heart's going to break. I can't find Personally Victimized, the season 2 ending of the Veronica Mars episode, and I can't find it online either. So people are still going back and like watching shows from the beginning with us like as an archive, and I can't find that episode. I'm going to look really hard to find it. I don't know where else it could be, but I'm really just disappointed because that's like a pinnacle episode of Veronica Mars Rewatchable.
Wait, like it's not on the Pipeable website?
I don't know. No, it's weird. I'll talk to you afterwards about like where it might be.
Yeah.
It's strange.
That's not good.
We got to find that. I know people like that one. It was a good one.
Oh, my God. It still makes
Caitlin
me like...
Caitlin the one
like,
that said Beaver personally victimized her?
Basically, that episode still makes me sick to my stomach, but
I know.
It's cool.
Yeah. No, I agree. I don't like the way that ends at all. Anyway, Shelley Bookworm said, rewatching Korra season 1 and at Rewatchable has made it impossible for me not to see Lindzen. You're welcome. Karen, you want to take the next one?
Yes. Avatar Central says, hey, Rewatchable, it's been a while, but I've still been listening weekly. Glad it seems like you're liking book 3. Just wait until book 4. Hi, and I know that Brittany interacts with you guys a lot more than I do, but I see a lot of your tweets, and you guys are always so nice and talk to us a lot. So that's really great, and
yeah,
keep it coming.
I was pumped that they tweeted us because it has been a while, and I was like, oh, they're back. They're back. It's fine. They're back.
Yeah, that's awesome. Very, very cool. Brittany, you want to take the first comment?
Yeah. So Frederick said on our post on Hypeable, remember when Azula fired the Dai Li because they were 5 minutes late? This wasn't such a bad and crazy decision after all. You definitely shouldn't entrust your life to the Dai Li.
I
agree. Yeah, I would not want to entrust my life to the Dai Li ever, or the lives of anyone I know.
I really hope they got rid of the Dai Li. Like,
yeah.
Just this isn't working. Get rid of them.
Well, they're just so backstabbing, and they just go with whoever's the more in power. So it's why wouldn't – well, I guess she's kind of a dumb lady to, like, eat the bear and whatnot. So it just – it feels like you should have had the foresight, though, to, like, look at the history of the Dai Li and be like, okay, maybe we can call them something different. Maybe they'll act differently if we just, like, call them, like, the Sunshine Rainbow Crew.
No, listen, if you want bodyguards – I get that you want bodyguards. And if you want people to, like, keep your culture, whatever, then you want people to keep your culture together. You do not combine those. You do not give the cultural authority military authority. Like, this is BS. It's so dumb. Stop it. You know, whatever. Kiyoshi, bad call. Bad call.
It makes me sad that Kiyoshi is the one that came up with this because I like her otherwise, but
she's awesome. But I like that she made a really, really dumb decision. I mean, this happens every single time. Like the Avatar always makes a few decisions that seem logical at the time and are good decisions theoretically, and then come back to bite the world in the next Avatar, which is how life works, unfortunately. Mitch, you want to grab the email from Rick?
Sure. This email comes from Diedrich, and she was writing in about the comparison between Bloodbending's illegality and keeping the spirit portals open. She wrote, I wanted to pose a question for debate regarding the separation of humans and spirits via leaving the spirit portals open or closed. With this topic, I couldn't help but draw some comparisons to the debate you were having over bloodbending and whether or not it should be made illegal. A few of you thought that making bloodbending illegal wasn't the answer, and that it would be better to have any bloodbenders trained to understand the consequences of their ability and learn to use it for good. Couldn't a similar argument be made for the spirits and whether or not they should be kept separate from humans? Just curious to hear your thoughts on the matter. Keep up the great work, Rick. And I think this is interesting because the email went more into depth to say things like, you know, there are good spirits and bad spirits. Why should we ban all spirits altogether? That's the same equivalent of banning all bloodbending together. I think there's something to be said there. I do think that there are certain times when a spirit can come in handy. Like there's Boomju, right? You know, he's a good guy. And we have those little, like, puffy things that help out Janora whenever she's in a Deus Ex Janora moment. So, like, they're not all bad. That's cool. We have Zaboomafoo. Rip.
Aww. Wait, Rip? He died?
I think so, because then, remember, Juan wakes up after he's trying to fuse with Rava, and they're like, oh, well, all your friends are dead. Bye.
That episode was dark as whatever. I don't actually see these two things being comparable. I think that spirits aren't going to follow laws, period. I mean, they're spirits. Like, it doesn't, like, it's like trying to, like, you know, enforce law on nature. I think that, you know, whether or not, you know, you think that there are more good spirits than bad spirits, I guess would determine your opinion on whether or not the portal should be kept open or not. I think there's also an argument to be made that there are no bad spirits, that because they are like a force of nature, like is a hurricane bad? Like, yeah, it's bad for humans, but it's not evil. You know, and if you can reduce that, and I mean, the interesting thing as well is that the spirits, and I guess whether they're good or like bad for humans, depends on kind of what the humans are doing at the time, doesn't it? So like, you know, with a lot of the evil quote unquote spirits that we saw were influenced by Unalaq and all that. So
I just don't see what benefit the spirits really have to humans, because I don't think they actually do anything but cause trouble or just kind of sassy every once in a while. But that's pretty much it.
Well, I think there might be an argument to be made that there's sort of an ineffable benefit, you know, that humans and spirits are like, they are linked and they're sort of meant to be together in some way. I think that there was definitely a negative balance toward the spirits in Juan's time, for example, you know, but like, is the negative balance toward humans, where like spirits are basically not at all involved in the world in Korra's time, is that the right answer? You know, like, I don't know. But as I've said before, I don't think that bloodbending should be allowed, period. I don't think anybody like realize, like, just accidentally bloodbends. It's something that comes out through evil, and I think it should be like, no, this is bad, don't do it, you're gonna go to
jail. Like your comparison of spirits to hurricane, because I think that kind of hits at home that, yeah, you can't control a hurricane or spirits. Does it make them innately evil? No. And that's where this argument falls down in my eyes. Maybe Karen or Brittany can redeem something we're not seeing, though.
We've been talking for a long time. It's hard to talk philosophy at this point.
I know. And I'm sort of just like, I don't like bloodbending, and I don't think it should be even brought to public attention. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's going to come out in, like, these evil situations, and yes, it should be, like, outlawed, but it's kind of only going to happen if that person is, like, you know, bent on killing someone or doing something like that. So, I don't know. I am very against bloodbending, so I don't have any more theories than that.
I agree.
Well, thank you for writing in, Diedrich. We appreciated you posing such an interesting debate. I wouldn't have thought of that before you brought it up.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, that comes to the end of our listener feedback. Again, you know where to send it to us if you'd like to. Thank you guys so much for listening. We will be back next week with the beginning of season 4. Oh my goodness, it's the end, and you're going to start to realize all the hashtags we've been talking about if you haven't already. I am Michal.
I'm Karen.
I'm Brittany.
And I'm Mitch.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.